Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for July 6th, 2025, I will be reading two articles for you today, including His Aim is True, Luke Littler, the world's best pro darts player, is just 18 and he's helping put his sport on the map. But first, Trump got the fight he wanted. Did it turn out the way he expected? The president's clashes with Los Angeles over immigration were a decade in the making, and their outcome remains unclear. This article was written by Charles Homans. On June 7th, Cruz was walking to buy tamales with her sister in San Bernardino, California, when she saw a truck full of landscapers being detained by what appeared to be law enforcement officers in unmarked uniforms. Cruz, a 28-year-old nurse's assistant, is a first-generation Mexican-American who was born in California, but her husband is an undocumented immigrant who worked on a similar landscaping crew. She asked to be identified by only her last name for her family's safety. When the Trump administration's raids targeting undocumented immigrants reached the city, word of the arrests spread quickly. But Cruz had not taken the news too seriously until she saw one for herself. The next week, on the morning of June 13th, her husband called to say he'd been working on Waterman Avenue when a truck full of federal agents pulled up. They appeared to be from Homeland Security Investigations, one of the many federal agencies now scouring Southern California for undocumented immigrants. When an officer asked him if he had a visa, he told the truth. Minutes later, he was in the back of a government vehicle bound for the Metropolitan Detention Center, a federal facility in Los Angeles. For nearly a week, such raids had spurred small protests in several cities in the region. Federal agents fired less lethal munitions at protesters shortly after President Trump, casting images of the clashes as evidence of citywide anarchy wrought by undocumented immigrants and their defenders, announced that he was federalizing control of the California National Guard and deploying it to address, quote-unquote, lawlessness. After protests gave way to rioting on the blocks around the detention center on the night of Sunday, June 8th, he announced he was deploying U.S. Marines. By the morning after the arrest of Cruz's husband, a small number of Marines deployed to an American state over the public opposition of its elected government stood around the loading dock of the detention center with M27 rifles and riot shields. They stood alongside soldiers from the California National Guard and officers whose vest patches said Police, DHS, denoting their affiliation with the Department of Homeland Security. Since the George Floyd demonstrations of 2020, Trump had vocally supported deploying the military to quell violent protests on American streets, a move he had flinched at doing at the time, but now was at last making. It was a natural conclusion of the story Trump told on the campaign trail last year about what had happened to America, what his enemies had done to America, and what he would do if elected again to restore it. Order will be restored, Trump wrote. The illegals will be expelled and Los Angeles will be set free. Trump has a well-honed gift for identifying and exploiting weakness in others, and his promised liberation of California was a natural, bigger budget sequel to his campaign of humiliation against Ivy League universities earlier this year. Each leveraged paralysis among Democratic and liberal elites over issues that inconveniently split their constituencies. Gaza, immigration, activist street politics, and the images that the paralysis produced of those elites helpless to contain the excesses of those constituencies. The paralysis became the justification for Trump to do what Trump most liked to do, which was wield the power of the state to bring his enemies to heel. Trump often advances his goals through images, and the images his administration was producing in Southern California were as filmic as anything in Hollywood. There were the videos of men in balaclavas and unmarked vans swooping down on farm fields and garment factories, which drove protesters into the streets in and around Los Angeles. There were the images of federal agents facing off against the protesters with tear gas and pepper balls. There were images of demonstrators waving Mexican flags in front of burning cars, the backdrop for Trump's pronouncement on Truth Social that a once great American city, Los Angeles, has been invaded and occupied by illegal aliens and criminals and overrun by violent insurrectionist mobs. He authorized administration officials to take all such action necessary to liberate Los Angeles from the migrant invasion and put an end to these migrant riots. And finally, here were the Marines rolling into Los Angeles as if it were a foreign capital. But the story the images from Los Angeles were telling did not always extend far beyond the frame. The undocumented immigrants swept up in the raids by ICE and other agencies in recent months, based on the limited data available, appear to be overwhelmingly without criminal records, not the violent invaders that Trump had conjured in so many speeches and all caps Truth Social posts. And apart from more serious disturbances like blocked freeways and some damage to businesses, the rioting might have underwhelmed anyone who had been downtown after a Lakers championship victory. It was the sort of disturbance the Los Angeles Police Department was easily equipped, enthusiastic even, to contain. The National Guard was prohibited by law from doing more than protecting federal agents and posting up outside a handful of federal buildings downtown. So were the Marines, who were not seen on the street in Los Angeles until June 12th, when a handful of them suddenly appeared meandering back and forth on the lushly garden grounds of the federal building on Wilshire Boulevard in a placid corner of the Westwood neighborhood, several miles west of the protest zone, where conflict between protesters and law enforcement officers was largely subsiding. Neighborhood residents strolling past on their way back from picking up lunch salads or out walking expensive-looking dogs greeted them less as liberators than as curiosities. "I don't know why they're here," Van Nguyen, a marketing director who works in the neighborhood, told me as she watched them standing guard beneath a flowering jacaranda tree. "This whole thing is kabuki," Gavin Newsom, California's Democratic governor, told me. "There are some professionals here, some patriots in the military," he said. "They're struggling under very difficult circumstances and recognize the absurdity of this." Still, something very real was happening amid all this unreality. A production that the president was intent on staging, one he seems keen to perform again. The structural dynamics of the Los Angeles protests, a federal immigration crackdown in a Democratic-run urban area, leading to local protests that the president presents as a threat to law and order so severe that the military must be deployed to contain them, leading to further protests over the crackdown itself, will surely play out through Trump's second term. In a June 15th post on Truth Social, Trump contended that the cities targeted by the immigration raids, like Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York, are the core of the Democratic power center, where they use illegal aliens to expand their voter base, cheat in elections, and grow the welfare state, robbing good-paying jobs and benefits from hard-working American citizens. To Newsom, the Truth Social post had been a statement of purpose, one that revealed what this whole strange moment was really about. "I credit him with saying it so loudly and clearly," he said. the missive reflected a convergence that occurred in Trump's worldview during the 2024 election. During the campaign, there was a significant evolution of his rhetoric in which illegal immigration, urban unrest both real and imagined, and his 2020 election loss were not just connected, but intentional, strands in a deliberate plot by the Democratic Party to seize permanent power. He had talked of this plot for months, and now at last he was taking action on it. A week into the conflict he engineered, though, it was beginning to look as if Trump had miscalculated. After the cinematic clashes of the first few days, the protests generated few of the images that served the narrative of Democratic fecklessness and impotence. The theatrical harshness and ominous secrecy of the immigration raids, meanwhile, had forced Americans to confront their ambivalence about immigration. "I'm always very respectful to the cops," a man told me early on the evening of June 9th. He grew up not far from downtown and had been coming out to protests every day since they began. "I tell them we love them. We don't have a problem with them. We're not mad at them. We're mad at ICE." It was the day after the most explosive confrontation downtown, and the man, who did not want to be named, was cruising down Alameda on an electric scooter toward where a line of Los Angeles police officers was squaring off against a couple of hundred protesters. "Yesterday was bad," he said. "They hurt the heart of L.A., you know." The previous afternoon and evening, several Waymo self-driving vehicles were set on fire, and several California Highway Patrol cruisers were damaged by a variety of projectiles. Downtown was blanketed in graffiti. Still, the man was critical of the vision of the protests that was reaching the world beyond Los Angeles. "There's news reports that are saying that the people are doing anarchy," he went on. "There's news reports who say the police are doing bad." Neither, to his mind, was true. "The cops just want to keep the community safe, and we're just making a statement that we don't want ICE messing with people." It was a Monday, and downtown was quiet. The protesters seemed outnumbered by the police. As darkness fell, a now familiar kind of shift change occurred as peaceful protesters drifted home and black masked radicals and young people appeared to be out for a mostly apolitical kind of trouble filtered in. On a side street in Little Tokyo, I came upon a group in balaclavas pushing a pair of dumpsters toward a line of police officers around the corner on First Street. The police responded with a salvo of less lethal munitions. A young man lay prone on the ground, clutching a leg wound. In politics, such chaos tends to work in favor of whoever is promising to contain it, a fact that advocates of protest politics routinely discount, and one that Trump recognized and acted on swiftly in Los Angeles. Over the first, worst days of unrest, the car fires and police clashes spanned only a handful of blocks in an enormous city that otherwise went on indifferently. No buildings were burned, and while vandalism was rampant, damage to businesses was far less extensive than in the upheavals of 2020. But in politics, if you are explaining that people are only lighting cars on fire, you are probably losing. This was a problem for Democrats in 2020, when broadly peaceful protests over the killing of George Floyd by police officers in Minneapolis led to vividly destructive and occasionally violent rioting. In some cases, there was prolonged street fighting with the police in sections of several major cities that, like virtually all American cities, were run by Democratic politicians. Over the past several years, images from these upheavals have informed Republican politics and especially Trump's politics to a degree that most liberals don't appreciate. From his first campaign rallies of the 2024 cycle, Trump's speeches were soaked in vivid accounts of once great cities in terminal decline, presided over by hapless or actively malevolent Democratic politicians incapable of ensuring the welfare of their citizens. These accounts were often exaggerated and sometimes invented, but they were credible to crowds of rural and suburban voters who had mostly encountered the protests and rioting of 2020 through Fox News video edits. Antifa and other groups burn down cities, kill people, go free, and don't even in many cases get prosecuted, Trump said at a rally in Rapid City, South Dakota in September of 2023. This battle that we're in is a battle for all of us, that is, for history. This is historic. This is a big moment in our country because we're either going to go one way or the other, and if we go the other, we're not going to have a country left. He spoke more than once of regretting not sending in the military to restore order in these cities when he had the chance, and over time began to speak of other situations in which such a deployment would be warranted. Perhaps, he mused in 2023, he would use the military to clean up the crime dens of New York and Chicago. In an interview shortly before Election Day, he spoke in his vague and sweeping way about people from within, the radical left lunatics who could be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military. And of course, there was the border, the front line of Joe Biden's conspiracy to overthrow America that logically extended to anywhere else migrants went. The images that the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security released over the week of chaos in California of uniformed agents and soldiers on the ground can be seen as a sort of bookend to the images of 2020 chaos. The federal agents Trump dispatched to sweep up migrants played a double role in this narrative. They were the long arm of Trump's law, reaching deep into hostile Democratic territory to seize the invaders. And when they inevitably became the target of protests, they were also the justification for sending in the troops, who, Trump was proclaiming before a single Marine had even been seen on the streets, had restored order to a city unable to restore for itself. "We are not going to let a repeat of 2020 happen," Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, told CBS's Face the Nation on June 8th. Immigration has always been the fight that Trump wanted to have with Democrats since the beginning of his first presidential campaign in 2015, when he cast undocumented immigrants as violent invaders threatening Americans' lives and the country's national security. And during his first term, immigration was the fight that Democrats wanted to have with Trump, too. In 2017, in response to Trump's first push to find and deport undocumented immigrants, the California State Senate passed the California Values Act, the most sweeping sanctuary law in the country, which prohibits state and local law enforcement officers from cooperating in federal immigration enforcement except in the cases of those convicted of serious or violent crimes. It was part of a broader effort by California's Democratic leadership at the time to make the state a sort of liberal redoubt in a newly MAGAfied America, a state economically and physically larger than many countries where laws, courts, and citizens would hold the line against the new administration's attempts to roll back the liberal values that the numerical majority of American voters who did not cast ballots for Trump presumably shared. Among the law's champions was Gavin Newsom, then the lieutenant governor and a candidate for governor. "You are looking at the poster child for sanctuary policy," he declared at a town hall-style meeting in Salida that August, pointing to a similar policy that he had maintained as mayor of San Francisco. In the 2024 election, a narrow plurality of American voters did cast ballots for Trump, and polls reliably found that the former president was trusted by more Americans on immigration than either Kamala Harris or Joe Biden, who appeared paralyzed in the face of an influx of asylum seekers at the border during his presidency. And Newsom, now a likely future Democratic presidential candidate, has, in recent years, struck a new tone. As governor, he has vetoed and recently threatened to veto again a law that would expand sanctuary protections. I've been in a different space versus some members of my party for many years in this respect, he told me. He pointed to his record of cooperating with federal agencies on migrants who are violent offenders and therefore not protected by the state sanctuary law. He argued that he was more moderate on the issue than many of the state's mayors. While not disavowing the existing sanctuary law, he was quick to note that he took the baton of pre-existing law, one that was signed years prior to my tenure as governor. But this was precisely the state of affairs that made California such a ripe target for Trump. Legally, the state's leaders and police agencies could not cooperate with the federal agents swarming across California, but they couldn't stop them either. They could only look on, appearing helpless to the right and the left alike. Weeks after Trump's re-election, Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles rushed to expand the city's sanctuary protections, but the presence of arrested migrants in the federal detention center in the middle of her city made clear how limited such provisions were in reach and how powerless city officials were in the face of a determined effort to flout them. On June 10th, Bass addressed a crowd that had gathered for a prayer vigil in Grand Park, across the street from City Hall. "Our message is to stop the raids," she said from the stage. "It has to end." The line was met with applause, but it was strange to see a sitting mayor resorting to the tools of outsider activism in her own city, a reminder of how little, in that moment, her official power counted. Immigration lawyers trying to reach the migrants in the detention center had not fared much better. "We don't have much visibility into where they are being held there, how long, where they're going next," said Eva Bittrin, the director of the Immigrants' Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California. What Bittrin did know was that many of the detainees from Los Angeles seemed to be getting sent to the Adelanto ICE Processing Center, a detention facility hours northeast of the city that is operated by the private prison contractor GEO Group. A recent lawsuit settlement happened to have provided the ACLU access to weekly reports on the population of the facility, which was now offering one of the few official windows into where detainees were being taken in the region. The latest report showed that the inmate population had jumped to about 1,000 from about 300 in the space of a single week. Early on the morning of June 13th, I drove out to Adelanto with the photographer Philip Montgomery. 2 hours outside Los Angeles, in the high desert of rose-colored earth and Joshua trees, we came upon a wide, flat, beige building, an unassuming structure that resembled a fortified Costco. Around the corner, an outdoor yard enclosed with a double fence of chain link and concertina wire was visible. In the yard, men in baggy white shirts and black pants were working out on some Spartan exercise equipment. When a guard saw us observing them from an adjoining dirt road, he called out, "Get back inside!" The men were hustled into the building. In the parking lot outside the building, there was a handful of unmarked white buses and vans. The front door was locked and no one answered the intercom. But a few minutes later, a man in a blue GEO Group uniform materialized. I identified myself and asked if we could visit the facility. He said he would go check. "Hate to be that guy," he said when he returned several minutes later, "but we've got to secure the facility, and we have to secure it with you outside of it." "Why?" I asked. Just something we do these days, he said. As we were leaving, we drove back down the dirt road facing the yard, where the men were once again working out. Asked if they had been detained by ICE, one man nodded vigorously. La migra, sí, sí, he shouted, using the catch-all Spanish term for the immigration authorities, before the guard once again sent them inside, out of our view. That evening, I rode to Cruz's house with Lisbeth Albelln, the deputy director of the Inland Coalition for Immigrant Justice, one of the many activist and community groups in the region that was trying to locate and arrange legal support for detainees in the raids. Darkness was falling as we pulled up outside a small bungalow with a half-disassembled truck on cinder blocks in the driveway. A cat eyed us curiously from the low roof as a breeze stirred the palm trees. Cruz emerged from the house, her 9-month-old son in her arms. Her husband had managed to hang on to his phone after his arrest, and throughout his processing, he furtively texted and called Cruz, updating her on his situation. He was still at the Federal Detention Center in Los Angeles, where immigration lawyers had heard the detainees were held in a single small basement room. They're not feeding us, he told her earlier that evening. They have us change up like we're delinquents, like when President Bukele grabbed the Mareros, members of the Salvadoran gangs that Nayib Bukele, the Salvadoran president, imprisoned in the detention facilities that he has opened to the Trump administration to house deported migrants over there in his country. Now Cruz tried calling her husband again. He answered, whispering into the phone. The sun lit up at the sound of his voice. Da, he called out, da. We're going to try everything, Amor, she said. Thank you, Amor, he replied. Take care of the children. It's crazy how fast everything is happening, said Cruz's younger sister, who had joined her outside. It's upsetting. Why the hard workers? Why not the people who are actually criminals? When Trump was running for president, she said, I didn't think it was going to be this bad. She had tried to look at the immigration issue with an open mind to see both sides. When all the immigrants crossed, I didn't think that was right. It wasn't fair to all the people that are here, that are doing it the right, that are fixing the papers, she said. But this isn't the right way, separating families. I didn't vote, by the way, she added. I don't believe in the voting thing. We said on so many occasions, Abel told me on the drive over, her voice rising with frustration. We know this is coming, mass deportations. Politicians from both parties had failed immigrants, she believed, but not only politicians had failed. No group had swung more drastically toward Trump in the 2024 election than Latino voters. Ebeln, who was born in Mexico, said she saw people of color falling into the narratives that were put out by the Trump administration. That Trump's promised immigration crackdown would affect only criminals, that it was possible to determine who deserved to stay in the United States and who did not. They fell into that trap, she said, and now we're here, right? At the same time, Trump's California campaign, in its extremity, had a sort of clarifying effect. His approval rating had fallen since it began, as had public opinion on his handling of immigration. The broad American view of immigration enforcement might be best described not as support or opposition, but as ambivalence and cognitive dissonance, a fact that worked for Trump in November but seemed to be working against him now, as people were confronted with the reality of what his hardline policies meant on the ground. Images of armed soldiers deployed in an American city and masked agents accosting random gardeners had drawn attention to the aspect of Trump's experiment in hard power as domestic politics that his base loves but Americans broadly oppose. The more people paid attention to what was happening in Los Angeles, according to one Washington Post poll, the less they approved of Trump's handling of it. At the same time, it was hard, in Los Angeles, not to think about the counterfactuals. What if the street clashes had escalated to 2020 levels? What if they had lasted days longer or spread to other cities, as with the George Floyd protests? The troops were still in Los Angeles, while Newsom's government challenged the deployment in court. In the meantime, the raids were continuing apace in Los Angeles and elsewhere. Some of them, a reported attempt by federal agents to gain access to Dodger Stadium on June 19th, for instance, a game day, seemed designed to provoke a response. Were they looking for immigrants or looking for a spark? "They'll go someplace else," Trump said of the protesters on June 18th, "but we'll be there too. We'll be wherever they go." I would like to now just take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And our next article, an 18-year-old prodigy may be DART's first global superstar. Luke Littler, the world's best pro darts player, is just 18, and he's helping put his sport on the map. This article was written by Oliver Huang. Luke Littler doesn't remember when he first threw a dart at a dartboard, but there is a video of him doing so at 18 months old. The year was 2008 in Cheshire, England, where Littler was born. His father drove a taxi and his mother worked in a candle shop, and like many families in the area, they watched professional darts on TV at home. The pastime had grown over the decades from a working-class hobby to a national fixation, and by the 2000s, the prize money for winning the Professional Darts Corporation's World Darts Championship, the biggest tournament in the sport, was over £100,000. It might as well have been deposited directly into the pocket of Phil Taylor, who won the event 14 times between 1995 and 2013. For families like the Littlers, darts popularity meant new dreams. Your child didn't need to be the next Beckham. He could be the next Taylor. In that home video from 2008, you can sense a nascent promise. Littler, wearing a diaper and a baseball hat too big for his head, lifts his right arm and flings a dart at a magnetic board. For all his toddler awkwardness, the movement is instinctive, even graceful, his fingers pointing downward for a moment before they quickly grasp another dart from his left hand. When he finishes his third throw, he holds his final pose for a second, his torso twisting slightly, as Taylor's often did, and then turns toward the camera, an open-mouthed smile plastered on his face. Luke was in his nappies and he was throwing like a professional, Polly James told me on a recent spring night in Newcastle. James covers darts for Sky Sports, England's largest sports television network, and she was sitting backstage at the Utilita Arena watching a broadcast of the event there. It was the eighth night of the Premier League, a four-month-long competition run for the world's best darts players, and the arena, which seats 11,000 people, was sold out. Many were there just to see Littler. "He's all anyone wants to hear about," James said. After making the finals of the 2023-24 World Championship as a 16-year-old, Littler completed the most successful rookie season in darts history, winning 11 titles, including the Premier League and the 2024-25 World Darts Championship, and earning more than £1 million in prize money. Now 18, he is widely considered to be the best darts player in the world. He is already ranked number 2 after just a year and a half of professional play. Darts rankings are based on tournament winnings over a 2-year period. Starting tomorrow, he will compete against 15 other top pros at the U.S. Darts Masters in Madison Square Garden. In a sport that has been historically dominated by middle-aged men with paunches, his talent seems to both fascinate and disorient fans. Many, like James, bring up the 2008 video as an attempt to account for what can otherwise seem like a magical ability. "It just seems so effortless," one fan told me in Newcastle. "He just gets up there and he does it." Littler was facing the sixth-ranked player in the world, Stephen Bunting, in the first match of the night. Fans walked around balancing pints of beer, breaking spontaneously into chants. It has become a tradition, encouraged by the Professional Darts Corporation, for fans to dress in costume for big events, and on this occasion they came as minions, inflatable flamingos, bananas, shrimp, ninja turtles, and Borats. PDC players compete exclusively in a game called 501, which is the number of points you have to secure exactly before your opponent does in alternating visits or rounds of three dart throws. As Littler warmed up, noise swirling around the arena, it was hard to overlook how much he still resembled the 18-month-old in the video. His body composed, his arm flashing to his side after a throw, his eye turning automatically toward the camera. At the front of the stadium floor near the stage, a cluster of teenagers and children wearing darts jerseys looked out of place in the rowdy atmosphere. It was a scene you didn't see a year and a half ago. Across Britain, the allure of Littler's success has inspired youngsters to join darts clubs in the hopes of following in his footsteps, what many people are calling the Luke Littler effect. Within the crowd were a father and son, the former dressed in a skin-tight Robin suit and the latter like Batman. The father told me that tickets to the event were the boy's Christmas present. If it wasn't for Littler, no one would be here, he said, gesturing at the children around him. This was known as an old man's social club. A man in front of us turned and nodded. He joined the darts league last year because of Littler, he said, putting a hand on his son's shoulder. There's now a waiting list of 50 or 60 for that league. Littler's first six darts were perfectly placed, the crowd roaring in approval, and he swept Bunting in less than 11 minutes. It's like he can do it when he fancies, Wayne Martle, a darts commentator, said, a note of awe creeping into his voice. Obviously you can't because it's not that simple, but it's like he can. The first father adjusted his tights. He's like Messi, he said, but Messi was then. Littler is now. I met Littler in early April, a week after the Newcastle event. He was in Berlin for the next Premier League competition, and we spoke in the back of the Uber Arena, which was sold out. On stage, Littler is confident, often needling spectators when they root against him, but in person he comes off as the teenager of stereotype. It was a designated media day for the PDC, and Littler had hours of back-to-back interviews with German television channels and international outlets. When he entered the room, bare white walls, fluorescently lit, he looked around and, not seeing any cameras, shrugged and pulled out a nicotine vape. "Why not?" he said, sucking at it. Littler's first foray into competitive darts was in 2016 at the St. Helens Youth Darts Academy when he was 9. Carl Holden, one of the academy's leaders, recalls the first time Littler's father brought him in. "We knew he was a different animal altogether," he told me. Littler began playing darts non-stop, as he puts it, at least 4 times a week. At 10, he was entering under-21 tournaments and then local pub tournaments, where he would beat 40- and 50-year-old men. In 2021, at 14, he left the academy and traveled around the country to play in a national league for teenagers run by the Junior Darts Corporation. When he was 15, he won the JDC's World Championship. He turned professional the year after that. "He is the best player I've seen in my entire life," said Neil Devlin, a St. Helens resident who 6 years ago lost in a tournament to Littler, then 12. It is difficult to say what makes Littler so good. As an activity, darts is distinctively static. Dartboards are like pies that have been cut into 20 equal slices, each labeled with a number between 1 and 20, indicating the point to be earned. A thin outer ring, a few millimeters wide, circles the edge. Its segments double the points for each slice. An even smaller inner ring through the midpoint of each slice triples the points. The most valuable part of the board is the treble 20, which is about the size of a small Band-Aid, so the most points you can score in a visit is 180. The bullseye is worth 50 and the ring around it 25. All this is standardized, as is the distance players stand from the board, just over 7 feet 9 inches. Every player's throwing motion is different, but the best ones are controlled and repeatable. Some players line the barrels of their darts between their eyes, tap their forefingers on the stems, twitch their mouths. They make hundreds of thousands of throws in a year, and when they struggle to hit their desired spot, you observe a disappointment that's less like that of someone who fails a difficult task and more like that of someone whose car fails to start on a cold morning. It's the realization that something you believe to be dependable actually isn't. Littler almost never appears to encounter this issue. He seems to sustain a faith despite contrary evidence that his every dart will go where he wants it to go. He experiments with his throw in the middle of competitions and goes for flashy, risky combinations in high-pressure moments. At a tournament in 2023 with the match on the line, Littler began shooting for the bullseye, at a half inch in diameter, the smallest region of the board, and squeezed in 4 darts over 2 consecutive visits to begin a successful comeback. He will often try to hit shots that his opponents have just missed, even when it disadvantages him. Stephen Bunting told me that Littler usually sits in the back room on his phone before a match, then throws casually at a board for 20 minutes while his opponent warms up for 3 hours. "He's a bit of an alien, isn't he?" Bunting said. "He does everything that you're taught not to do as a player." In Berlin, when I asked Littler to describe what sets him apart from other dart players, he didn't offer much clarity. Mostly he spoke in platitudes about a winning mentality, which seemed to consist of telling himself to just hit it. I couldn't blame him. There is something about top athletic performance that resists articulation. What made Michael Jordan such a great basketball player? Or Roger Federer, such a great tennis player? Beyond the obvious answers, speed, power, dedication to the craft, and so on, it's easy to drift into hand-waving. People talk about feel and elegance, intuition and clutch factor, about being born with a ball in your hands. But these descriptions tell you more about what it's like to watch someone perform than what it's like to actually perform, which in the end is what we really want to know. And those who know best, the people who are able to do what so fascinates us, are stuck trying to communicate their distinct subjective experiences to others who haven't experienced anything like it. Asking Littler to describe his darts playing is a bit like asking Mark Rothko to describe how he sees red. He just does. Maybe it is, in part, the inexplicability, or art, if you will, of Littler's play that has made him so popular. He has become one of the most recognizable names in Britain, benefiting from the growth of the PDC over the last 2 decades, at the same time he is now stoking it. According to the Britain-based bookmaker Bet365, darts wagers doubled between 2022 and 2024, reaching a level similar to that for tennis and cricket, and the purse for winning the world championship has grown to £1 million. Since 2020, viewership on Sky Sports for the World Championship has tripled, and in January, the network retained streaming rights to the PDC events in a deal that was reported to be £125 million over 5 years. The sport has expanded globally, with events around Europe and Australia. The U.S. Darts Masters is expecting record attendance at Madison Square Garden this weekend. Littler does not look like someone you would think to build a sport around. One YouTube comment in 2023 described him as the oldest-looking 16-year-old in the world. But in the 2023-24 World Championships, nearly 5 million people watched him lose to Luke Humphries, the top-ranked player in the world, in the finals on Sky Sports, more than doubling the number of viewers of any previous darts event. Immediately afterward, Humphries told me he started being recognized on the street, something that had only happened a few times before. Carl Holden told me that after Littler's 2023-24 World Championship performance, he began seeing lines stretch out the door of his shop, which could only hold a few dozen people at a time. One of the most popular items? A Luke Littler dartboard. Business increased threefold with more than 1,000 customers coming in on weekends, and Holden decided to change locations as a result. He also began fielding more requests for admission to his academy, which had about 70 members in 2023, but has grown to over 100 since then, with 200 people on the waiting list. I probably said there was about 100 to 150 kids playing darts at academies 3 years ago. 4 years ago, he said. That figure now must be near the thousands. In March, I attended a tournament in Coventry, England for the JDC Foundation Tour, an open competition for players between the ages of 10 and 17. More than 200 people showed up, including one who traveled from Mongolia. And Sean Casey Poole, then the JDC's director of operations, had to cut off registration for the first time ever. The building would have been over capacity. I always say to the new kids that come, believe it or not, Luke Littler used to play here, Casey Poole said. And they go, whoa, Luke Littler used to play here? That's crazy. Nearly all the players I spoke with told me that they had taken up darts within the past year or two and that they were hoping to play professionally. The day after we met, Littler faced Chris Doby, the current world number 7, in the first round of the night. The Berlin Stadium was packed and the crowd of 12,000 roared for Littler as he climbed the stairs to the stage. Earlier, when I asked him whether he feels pressure under the scrutiny of so many, he shook his head. It's like when you're just good at something, you just kind of want to keep doing it, right? He said. Sometimes you can obviously be up for it, but some days come around and you're like, I can't be bothered doing this. But you've still got to get up on stage. You've got to play. This comment seemed prescient as the match started. Littler immediately began missing throws that he would normally make. The crowd quieted. Then, after Littler finished a particularly bad visit, started to jeer him. Littler swiped at the air facetiously. It was hard to reconcile this image of a slightly impatient teenager with the figure who had become the face of darts. But Littler's appeal lies in that tension. It's the combination of his commonplace facade and his touched-by-God talent. He's both highly gifted and completely ordinary, both mythological and relatable. Littler continued to miss, smiling and shaking his head after each throw. He started throwing the darts faster, barely waiting to see where one landed before throwing another. As the loss appeared inevitable, he shrugged. He knew that as far as the Premier League standings were concerned, one match would prove inconsequential. He would go on to finish as the runner-up to Humphries in late May with total winnings of £185,000. Outside it was warm, the sky blue, the chants from the crowd faint. Somewhere a child was throwing darts at a board with Littler's name on the side. Lose or win, he was still the guy everyone was hoping to be. Oliver Wang, who wrote this article, is a writer based in Boston who last wrote for the magazine about addiction recovery. We still have a few minutes remaining, and so with that time, I'll read to you from the letter of recommendation section from this edition of the New York Times Magazine. Illness took my mother's independence, but it gave us something precious. An immune condition changed my mom's life and taught us to see art differently. This article was written by Elena Pokros. On a breezy evening in the year 2000, Mom walked barefoot out to the freezer in her garage, as a fourth-generation California is wont to do. But as she dug through the cave of icy corn dogs and Costco salmon, she was distracted by a startling sensation. Her right foot was cold atop the wind-chilled pavement, but her left foot was burning hot. Multiple sclerosis is best described as a disease of self-sabotage. As the body eats away at its nerve's protective exterior, the nervous system loses its ability to fire, leading over time to various debilitations. For Mom, this meant losing control of the left side of her body. Over the course of 5 years, she went from walking with a cane to supporting herself with her service dog's harness to eventually using a walker. If you were to map the development of her disability, it might look like Rudolf Zallinger's illustration of human evolution in reverse, beginning upright on 2 feet, but then morphing into a hunched-over figure, arms hanging like pendulums. My mom's transformation was hard for me to accept. I was a moody teen, more concerned with my high school microdramas than with my mother's ailments. I blamed her for everything that went wrong in my life without ever really considering how she might be privately struggling. The one tradition we did share was our trips to the mall, where we tried on clothes and ate our favorite Cobb salads. But eventually even those visits dwindled. In college, I finally realized that my mother could no longer trawl through the shoe aisle. Years later, living in New York, I saw a retrospective at the Met of the artist Alice Neal and was moved by a nude self-portrait she painted as an older woman, in which she sits in a striped armchair. There was so much dignity and defiance in her eyes, despite the sagging skin below them. A month later, when my parents visited, I knew I had to share what I had seen with my mom. Canes and handicap placards made Mom feel and look older than she was, but Neal demonstrated how aging could be beautiful and enchanting. And while museum-supplied wheelchairs were a few sizes too big for my mom's tiny frame, I knew she would enjoy visiting as much as I would. Hours passed quickly as I pushed her around the exhibit, moving toward the portrait of Neal. By this point, my mom had reluctantly accepted that riding in a wheelchair was the quickest way to navigate an airport terminal, and she had already bickered with a friend about whether she needed help getting around a London rose garden. But there is something different for me about pushing my mom around a museum, whispering in her ear as if she were a baby in a stroller. I'm more responsible for her now than she is for me. Looking at art from a wheelchair might have begun as a painful development for my mother, but it has since blossomed into something alive and serendipitous, one of the best remaining activities we can share together, and somewhat surprisingly, a lesson about how to actually start seeing. There are studies that show that people look at a piece of art in a museum for an average of just 27 seconds. Students of art history may be familiar with John Berger's idea that visitors are overwhelmed by their own culpable inability to concentrate on more than a few of these works, and so they can't distinguish the good from the bad. But seeing art with a disabled person requires a more thoughtful, more patient, and most important, slower approach. Once my mom and I went to the Whitney to see an Amy Sherald exhibit, perhaps a masochistic choice on the museum's only free day of the month. Each time my mom wanted to see a portrait, I had to ask oblivious bystanders to step back. Once we got close enough for her to read the wall text, I stood beside her, admiring the work and exchanging a few words until she told me she was done. When we pulled up to The Bathers, an oil painting of two women in swimsuits holding hands, I was struck by Sherald's astonishing hallmarks. bright yellows, reds, and purples against a cerulean background, realistic proportions and monstrous scale. But the longer I stood, the more her ingenious details stood out. A subtle head tilt on the swimmer on the left, light reflecting off her kneecaps and nose. Suddenly, the huge quantity of work on offer that Berger suggested the viewer complains about didn't seem to be a problem at all. When I first became aware of my mom's waning strength, I was angry. It felt unfair that she couldn't run down the sideline during my soccer games or turn into a raisin with me in a hot tub. Today, though, her fate no longer feels like a personal slight, but rather a misfortune that has returned as a gift. It's rewarding to get to the point in life when a child knows things I don't, my mom texted me recently. For me to experience these things temporarily outweighs the negative parts of seeing myself in a wheelchair. At the Met, when I wheeled my mom up to Neil's self-portrait, I took a step back and snapped a picture with mom sitting in the foreground. Here were two older women seated, locking eyes. Taking the picture wasn't a conscious decision as much as an impulse, some innate feeling telling me that this moment was worth remembering. When I look back at it now, I think about just how much my mom has taught me to slow down, and how I, hopefully, have given her permission to be okay with doing so. Elena Pokros, who wrote this article, is a writer and editor based in Brooklyn, New York. She is on the editorial staff at The Nation. Thank you so much for joining me for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.